just heard The Composition Dash by the American composer Jennifer Higdon as performed by the Verdaere Trio. The work composed in 2001 at a time when, according to the composer, speed seems to be our goal. Well, Jennifer Higdon literally dashed here from Philadelphia and made it and is my guest up until 11 o'clock today. Jennifer Higdon is indeed one of America's most frequently performed composers. She has been commissioned by literally an endless number of ensembles and performers and has been recognized by both critics and audiences as being communicative without compromising quality. Leslie Valdez, for example, of the Philadelphia Inquirer, has said the following: "There's no denying Higdon's compositional ease or abundance of ideas. Her music has something to say and often does so with eloquence." Again, those comments were by Leslie Valdez of the Philadelphia Inquirer. Jennifer, what can I say? I am honored and thrilled that you are here. Thank you so much for coming, especially in the heat. Jennifer Higdon was actually my guest 2 years ago, shortly after the release of two major orchestral scores on the Telarc label, Cityscape and Concerto for Orchestra. Jennifer, you have had obviously a tremendous amount of success. How does this all feel? Did you expect this popularity at all when you wrote one of your first pieces back in 1984, The Jeffrey Mode? How has all this changed your life, in other words, I'm sure?
Well, it's made everything go a lot faster.
Like Dash.
Yeah, just like Dash. Sometimes I think Dash reflects kind of the speed of my lifestyle. For instance, I got up at 3 o'clock this morning to compose before coming over here.
That was going to be my question later. When do you do all this writing? I mean, composers write you here a lot of the time, actually, well into the morning. Are you similar in that
respect? Well, you know, it's interesting. For me, I try to write any time I can get it in the day. I'm currently writing on a really tight deadline, so I'm writing between 4 and 7 hours a day. So I'm squeezing it in anywhere that I absolutely can. So yeah. My best writing is usually in the morning when I wake up. I find that my brain is not being interfered with the day.
Okay, well, that's great. Well, with all these things. How does it feel to have all these ovations and all these?
it's
don't
very,
be modest.
It's actually very surreal. I wake up in the morning and I say, "Is this really happening?" The amazing thing is, I have commissions running so far out in advance that I'm trying to plan at this point 2013 on my calendar because I have so much on my schedule to write.
Wow. And we'll be talking about some of those commissions. In fact, if I saw on your website, and I'm hoping even to be able to come down for that, you have a major piano concerto with Lang Lang here. That's going to be next season.
Yeah, that's what I'm working on right now.
Well, that I can hardly wait. Jennifer, we are going to be featuring your works throughout the morning. However, before we do, let us talk about your early training and how you got into music in the first place. Also, when did you get into composition?
Well, I was a real late starter. I taught myself flute at 15, and I didn't really start composing till I was 21. I was about two-thirds of the way through my bachelor's degree. I got interested in composing, and it was a little bit like getting bitten by a bug. I just started writing, and I still play flute, but the majority of my time is actually writing.
Yeah, I would imagine so at this point. Yes, well, our next selection, which I mentioned a few moments ago, The Jeffrey Mode, is one of your first pieces.
I think it may be Opus 1, actually.
Well, I'm very honored. In fact, that CD that we're playing from that, is that your very first release of your music or the first full one? Or
it actually is the first disc of, it may have been the first recordings of my music, period. Now that I think about it, but it's also the first solo disc where a composer has all one disc devoted
right,
to their music.
Right. I remember it. I remember when that came out. Gosh, 10 years ago?
Actually, you know, it's 10 or 11.
Is it that long? I remember that. Oh, my gosh.
Time flies.
Oh, my gosh. Well, let's discuss the title of the work.
The Jeffrey Mode was written actually in honor of a high school friend I was in marching band with, Jeff Tuck, played trumpet, and we were good buddies. We'd hang out on band trips. This is kind of appropriate because I just returned from Tennessee 2 days ago, and I saw Jeff there.
Oh, my gosh.
And we were talking about drum and bugle corps, which some of your listeners may know something about. Yeah, it's an unusual thing, but we were talking about the influence of band, how it influenced both of us in our lives. And for me, clear rhythm, I think, plays a part in my music, and it has to do, I think, with bands. So we were good buddies. We used to talk all the time. So one of my first assignments in composition was write a piece, pick a friend, and build a piece on the characters of that friend.
Well, you know, that's interesting because we're going to get into some of the little tips for composers, and I think you're kind of vaguely hinting some of this already.
Right, exactly.
But we'll get into that just a little bit. For now, we hear flute soloist Jennifer Higdon, my guest, and we also hear pianist Hugh Song. Once again, this is Jennifer Higdon's The Jeffrey Mode.
Thank you.
You heard flute soloist, my guest, Jennifer Higdon, along with pianist Hugh Song. That was Jennifer Higdon's The Jeffrey Mode. Today, up until 11 o'clock, I am being joined by one of America's most frequently performed living composers, Jennifer Higdon. Altogether, she enjoys more than 100 performances a year of her works. Also, her orchestral piece, Blue Cathedral, was the most performed work by any living American composer in 2004-2005, as reported by the American Symphony Orchestra League. Jennifer, welcome back. Thank you again so much for coming. One of the characteristics in so much of your music is that it literally, I have to say, jumps off the page.
Oh, that's good.
It is rhythmically exciting and just brilliantly written. And as thought actually leads us to an upcoming release of your work, Zaka. The opening of this selection has to be one of the most rhythmically exciting openings to any piece of music. What does the title refer to and when was it written?
Well, you know, the title is actually a word I made up. I knew I was writing a piece for 8th Blackbird and they commissioned two works. They wanted a closer, a 3-minute encore work. I came up with the word Zango Bandango, which they'll probably be recording in the next couple of years. But the first work I wrote for them was this work, Zaka. And I just made the word up. I was trying to think of something that sounded percussive. Now, the funny thing is when the group does this piece, I'm constantly having people who write program notes, annotators, contact me because they can't find this word in their dictionary. So they panic a little bit.
Well, what are some of the, I guess when I'm listening to it, I hear a number of very unique effects going on. Describe some of these to the listeners.
Well, you know, this group is just so good. I thought, well, I can really do a lot with them when I was writing. And the first sound you hear, the piano, pianist is standing up, has her hand on the inside of the piano. She's just stopping some of the strings on her instrument. And it's such an easy thing to do, and it's such an effective sort of sound. So I also, at one point, have a couple of the string players using crochet hooks. They're bouncing them along on the strings. It makes a very thin, controlled sort of sound. And I've got the flute doing all these extended techniques. I have an advantage being a flutist. I can actually mark which keys you're supposed to move where and when. Make those really bizarre sounds, but I wanted something that was just kind of a little off-sounding but very exciting.
Yeah, I mean, this is such a tour de force.
You know, when I was writing it, I thought, this group's so good, I should write a little miniature concerto for 8th Blackbird, so that was the idea.
Well, we're going to hear this ensemble now, and this is actually not out yet, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right. I think it's scheduled for September, if everything runs on schedule, which hopefully it does. Sometimes with CDs it does not, but
Sadie, I think is how they pronounce it. But that's fine. The music is great regardless. So let's hear it now. This is the composition Zaka by my guest, Jennifer Higdon. Thank you.
Thank you.
You just heard the composition Zaka by my guest Jennifer Higdon as performed by Eighth Blackbird. And that's from an upcoming release on the Sadie label. Once again, Zaka by Jennifer Higdon. Good morning. The time is 5 minutes after 9 on Wednesday, August 2nd. And you are tuned to WPRB 103.3 FM Princeton or online around the world at WPRB.com. Welcome to another edition of Classical Discoveries, the program devoted to rarely heard repertoire of all periods, with an emphasis on the old and the new. I am your host, Marvin Rosen, and I'm with you every Wednesday morning from 6 until 11. Thank you so much for joining me today. And, well, I am back with Jennifer Higdon. Jennifer, as a composer who is now very successful, what advice would you give to our young composers who are just breaking in? Do you have a few words of wisdom you would like to share?
Well, I usually tell composers, write as much as you can. Write for your friends, because those are the people who you'll work with the most. And you learn from hearing what you end up writing. Just try things out.
Right, right, right.
It's often, if you play an instrument, I find writing for the instrument that you play is very helpful, too, because people ask you to play the pieces. That's the way I really got a good start. So a lot of chamber music. Don't write big symphonies. That's often a problem getting those played. Write the little chamber things. That'll lead to bigger things down the road.
And you began writing a number of works for flute.
That's right.
And there you go. And you're a flutist. Words of wisdom. Well, Jennifer, let's proceed now to your soliloquy. This is a composition for English horn and strings. And we will hear a performance recently released by the Tasmanian Symphony Orchestra. This is from Australia, conducted by Sean O'Boyle. And this was released on ABC, the classics label from Australia. How did this come about?
You know, Sean actually did a call for scores. And ironically, I think he actually had this score of mine, because he told me that he had decided that he was going to put this recording out, but they had 400 scores come in.
That's what I read about that.
It's pretty staggering number when you think about it. And he just selected some of them to record. And this tells you how long it takes recordings to come out. I think it was like a two-year process from that call to the time that the disc, which is just a very recent release, has actually made it. And I'd be willing to bet this may be the first broadcast in the U.S. from this disc.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, I'm very honored and very excited, because everyone who listens to me knows that I enjoy this stuff. But also, if I'm not mistaken, didn't you make a transcription of this work much later on for cello?
Yes, you know, I've done a couple of transcriptions. And, yeah, there was a version for flute choir and cello and flute choir and English horn, which that's a little scary to think about. It sounds better with the strings, actually.
Yeah. Well, we're going to hear it now. The Tasmanian Symphony Orchestra is conducted by Sean O'Boyle, and this is the composition Soliloquy by my guest Jennifer Higdon.
Thank you.
The Tasmanian Symphony Orchestra was conducted by Sean O'Boyle in that performance of Jennifer Higdon's Soliloquy for English Horn and Strings. And that was from an ABC Classics label, Compact Disc, produced in Australia, which, by the way, is titled Soliloquy, the name of the work you just heard. Well, Jennifer, welcome back. So far, we have been listening to just instrumental selections, and we'll go to a choral work in just a moment. However, before we do, just describe for new people, I guess you could say, your musical style and influences, and have they changed over the years?
Well, I think I've probably been influenced by everything I've heard. I think that's the way it is for composers. I didn't grow up around classical music.
So
I did not. And that's a very, I came to classical music when I started college at the age of 18. That's very unusual.
Mm-hmm.
But so I suspect that there's got to be influenced by all the Beatles music I listened
That's
to.
That's what I was going to ask you. What did you listen to when you were younger?
A lot of folk stuff. Peter, Paul, and Mary. We had the Rolling Stones playing in our house. Also Bob Marley, so there was reggae. And an extraordinary amount of the Beatles, particularly the Sgt. Pepper's album, I think I must have listened to for one solid year, twice a day. And I think about that, it's a miracle. It doesn't just show up verbatim in my music.
And I find so many of our, if you want to call them classical composers, but I don't like that term at all now.
Somehow it just doesn't fit.
It doesn't fit. No, it doesn't fit at all. But I find that so many of our younger composers have been inspired by popular music in their works.
It's in the air. Everywhere you go, it's playing on train platforms and grocery stores. There's no escaping it, that's for sure.
No, that's right. Well, let's, Jennifer, I know you are generally more known as a composer of instrumental works, but you've also written some very beautiful vocal and choral compositions. How much have you actually written for voices?
Well, I'd say it's probably only about a 16th of my output. I think I have some choral works. I have some individual songs and one work for baritone and orchestra. But I must confess, two opera companies in the United States have been talking to me about an opera. So there may be more on the horizon before too long.
Oh, that will be exciting.
That would be, it's a little intimidating, I must confess. It's a very big project. Usually writing an opera takes 3-4 years.
Yeah.
So it's something to think about.
Well, Jennifer, we're going to go now to, I have to say, your very beautiful setting of Omanium Mysterium. When was this work written and for whom?
It was written a couple of years ago for the Philadelphia Singers. I've written quite a few of my choral works for them, and they wanted something with instruments involved. So being a flute player, I thought, why not put two flutes in there? And I also decided to add some crystal glasses and chimes.
Which is very appropriate for you anyway.
Right, exactly.
With Blue Cathedral and some
glasses and flutes and the chimes, it all kind of fits in.
Well, I remember the first time I heard your music, that's probably the first idea that I noticed, because when I heard the first piece of yours I heard, and we may have talked about this when you were here a couple of years ago or even off air, the first piece of yours I heard was Blue Cathedral, and it was at the Curtis Orchestra.
That's right.
It was on TV.
Yeah.
And was that January 1, 2000, or I was trying to remember when that was broadcast.
The premiere itself took place in May of 2000, so I'm guessing it
maybe
may have
2001.
Been, yeah, it might have been January. I don't know exactly when. I remember them taping it. They had all those trucks out there outside the Academy.
But I remember those glasses.
That's right.
In the video. Well, we're going to hear now Jennifer Higdon's setting of Omanium Mysterium. We hear the Handel and Haydn Society, conducted by Grant Llewellyn.
Thank you.
Handel and Haydn Society were conducted by Grant Llewellyn in Jennifer Higdon's very beautiful setting of Omnium Mysterium. Jennifer, we discussed earlier that you began as a flutist. How did your instrumental work actually influence you as a composer?
Oh, that's a good question. One of the things from learning new music myself I really value is trying to make the music playable and interesting for the performers, because there's nothing worse than having to spend hours and hours every day practicing something that's not comfortable on the instrument and not very interesting to listen to.
Well, now, even going many, many years since your first works, which we heard one of which earlier, do you still feel a closeness to your instrument when you write for a big ensemble?
You know, I do, but I try to be very careful about that. Everyone expects me to write huge
flute
long
music.
Flute. Yeah, exactly.
Long flute cadenzas in every work.
Exactly. So I try to refrain from that. I try to control it a little bit. But I also find it interesting to explore other colors. I know so much of the flute literature that now I'm kind of into like the piano and the clarinet. So I tend to veer into longer solos for those instruments.
Well, that's great. We are going to be listening shortly, Jennifer, to a major orchestral work of yours, the Concerto for Orchestra. The work was premiered by the Philadelphia Orchestra in Philadelphia on June 12, 2002. And I have to say, reading about that, you had an exciting experience when after the premiere, your picture was on the front page of the Inquirer.
It actually may have been one of the most terrifying moments of my life, not because my picture was on the front page of the Inquirer, but the Philadelphia Orchestra had decided to premiere this when the American Symphony Orchestra League Conference was in town. So the first night of, I'd never had a large orchestra work like this premiered, not anything in this length, but the first night, the entire audience was orchestra managers from around the world. So there were about 3,500 of them, and it's probably the most skeptical crowd that you can actually do a piece for. So they were coming in to hear the Strauss on the second half. They were looking at the program saying, "Who is this Jennifer Higdon?"
Well, I guess now everybody knows.
It was an evening that actually changed my life. The phone ringing the next day.
I'm sure. You had another work premiered by the Philadelphia Orchestra just this past season. Your percussion concerto was played, which was co-commissioned by the Philadelphia, Indianapolis, and Dallas Symphony Orchestras. I was actually at one of the Philadelphia performances and was so excited with the music, and I have to also say that I never saw such an ovation for a new piece in my life, and it was very difficult staying and listening to Tchaikovsky, in all honesty, right after that.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. When we took this piece on the road to Indianapolis and Dallas, they realized that the program would be problematic. I think there was Brahms on the second half of one of the concerts. Too many people were leaving after the percussion concerto, so both of those orchestras ended up reversing their programs. They put the older work on the first half and put my piece on the second half. Now, normally with new music, they put it on the first half because they figure people will stay for the older work, but they were having the opposite problem.
Well, you know, that leads me to our next discussion, because this is something which I am always dealing with, because I've done many talks about new music, and I always start off the presentation. If there's a new piece of music in a concert and it's the first piece, are you going to go and experience the work, or are you going to sit and have another cup of coffee? And the response overwhelmingly is, I will stay and have another cup of coffee. Now look, Jennifer, your music has been enjoyed by masses of people. It is exciting, vibrant, rhythmic, and melodious. And these comments can also be applied to many other living composers as well. However, if this is the case, how come many still associate new music as music that is difficult? And what can we change so that new music can get the excitement it deserves?
Well, I think part of it has to do with radio. I think that the stuff gets played on the radio, and so people hear it and they're like, oh, you know, that's not too bad. It helps to have recordings out there. And I've noticed in the past 5 years, there's starting to be a change with the orchestras. I've talked to a lot of administrators who do the programming and a lot of conductors, and they say now that they're noticing an actual difference. In fact, I know when I was down in North Carolina, I did a residence with the symphony down there. They were doing the Concerto for Orchestra. They sold out all their concerts. All the concerts were new music. My piece, the Concerto for Orchestra, was the oldest piece on the program.
And that's not that old.
I know. It's actually only a couple years old. And amazingly, people started coming back on repetitive visits. Now, that's something an orchestra
should use. So that's definitely a good sign.
It's definitely
that's
what a good
I like.
Sign.
That's what I like
that's
to
right,
hear.
Right, exactly.
And that leads me to another idea-related topic. I mean, I think we have to seriously think about our future audiences in music. I find personally, as a teacher, that students love our living composers right now.
That's true.
And and I'm also asked by these same students, why do we have to constantly be taught about this and that? Why do we have to listen to Mozart around the clock in classes? And I personally love the great masterworks, but I feel there needs to be some reevaluation as to where classical music, if we want to use that term, where it's going. In other words, what can we do to increase the interest in young people?
Well, I think, you know what, they tend to respond, if you talk to them and ask them a lot of questions, they respond to the newer music. They respond to new everything. It's the same that's with their true. Sneakers, the gadgets, the games. So the new music tends to speak to them. It's written in their time. It reflects their energy and their interests. And I think you can get them to listen to Mozart and Beethoven, but it actually works better if you go backwards. In other words, start with the music now.
That's exactly right. And that's what I always, when I have a class, a survey class, that's I always say, we are going to start by composers who could be just a little older than your older brother or sister.
Yeah, it works really well,
And I find it really works very well. And I think probably the most exciting thing is that when a student will say, they'll say, Mr. Rosen, that's really cool. And that my day is made because I feel there's some impact.
Absolutely.
Of positiveness going on. Well, Jennifer, we are now going to go to your Concerto for Orchestra, which was premiered, as mentioned, by the Philadelphia Orchestra on June 12, 2002. As a brief introduction, it's a long piece, 36 minutes. What would you like to say before we hear it?
Well, it's kind of a roller coaster ride through the orchestra. The first movement shows off everybody. The second movement features just the strings. The third movement solos all around for all the principal players, so you get to hear everybody. The fourth movement is the most unusual, percussion and keyboards. That's it, just because that's the section of the orchestra that developed the most in the 20th century. And finally, the last movement wraps it up with everybody again.
Well, we're going to hear this, and we hear the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Robert Spano, and this is the Concerto for Orchestra, a complete performance of it by my guest, Jennifer Higdon.